Hello, welcome to Conversations. My name is Kayleen Welsh, and I am your host for this episode. I'm super pleased to be joined in the studio at WDRT by Bill Burke, a local and regional historian and a friend. I've known Bill for quite a long time. And when I was preparing for this show and deciding what we wanted to talk about this time, I've been very aware of the Black Hawk Bridge and the impact of its closing in recent months. And so I thought it'd be fun to just learn a little bit more about that bridge. It's definitely an iconic piece to the area, well-known, is a symbol, really, for that Lansing and this regional crossing that it avails to people there. So when I was thinking about who to talk to about the Black Hawk Bridge, Bill, you were the first person that really came to my mind, because Bill is an expert on all things history related in the area and a great asset to our community for sharing the information that he gathers. So welcome, Bill.
Well, thank you very much for the invitation, Kayleen.
I was struck myself as the Black Hawk Bridge closed. I guess it was in February, late February, that it closed. And I have family over that way. I go that direction a lot. And I started hearing more and more stories about how difficult it was for people to get to work, all the people that come from the Wisconsin side of the river and go across to Lansing or other areas beyond, and how complicated that became for people's lives.
Well, if I could comment a little bit on that, I grew up in Lansing, and I grew up in a situation where that bridge was just a big chunk of steel extending across the Mississippi River. No one used it. They couldn't. It was closed down in those years. And it was just like, this isn't really part of our life. No one depends on it. There were other ways to get to La Crosse, at least, up on the Minnesota side. But we didn't know anybody right across the river 3 miles away in DeSoto, Ferryville area. Now we have a lot of friends over there. So it's been a revolution, the way it's been reopened, well, in 57. And then the shock to the community this year when the east part of the bridge had to be closed because of construction about 100 feet away on a new bridge. So the bridge has taken on a real dichotomous meaning for a lot of us, including myself.
I'd love to hear a little bit more about your history. Just how did you get interested in local history? How does this become such an important part of your life?
Originally I wasn't interested in history at all. But when my first job as a city planner in Iowa, I had the great advantage of working with a retired county engineer who had a kind of a history bug, and he was telling me all kinds of things about the Prairie du Chien area, the history there, the French, the fur trading. And I was just kind of amazed by how much he knew about my own backyard, which I didn't know, and I didn't care too much. But he had written a book, too, and I got a copy of it and read it. And I saw so many opportunities in just scratching the surface of where, if I just dug a little bit deeper, I'd find out just a whole lot more. And so my education and so forth at Iowa State University, taught me, or it required me to do a lot of research, a lot of digging, a lot of fact-finding. So I had some tools with respect to, how do I enhance my own knowledge of the history of the Mississippi River region in our area. And then, by the way, my own community, which I didn't really know too much about. So that's kind of the origin of my interest right there. And I began to find out the sources, a lot of sources of public information that of little or no cost. Government sources such as National Archives and National Geographic Society, the state government, of course, Secretary of State's office, and I dealt with some of those sources just in my ordinary work. So I started putting together an accumulation of data and documents and maps, and one of those sources would lead to maybe four or five other sources. And so pretty soon I was just loaded with information. At some point later on, I did write a book about some of that. But that's, I kind of stumbled into it, you might say, in answer to your question. And it's I've been at it since the late 1960s.
Well, let's share a little bit of information about the history of the bridge. Because as my understanding goes, it really started, the conversations about it began almost 100 years ago.
Well, actually, more than 100 years ago.
Okay.
The early authors of this idea, none of them were alive when the bridge was actually built, but they did have this germ of an idea about just crossing the river and getting to markets and other places in Wisconsin. Plus, there was a kind of a Chamber of Commerce-ish kind of attitude there that, what more can we do to make our community on the map, put us on the map, where something that we can brag about, so to speak. And, of course, in those days, a lot of communities had only been founded for maybe 50 years or so, and so they had some of the basics already established for the community. And so what can we do now? What else can we do? And this was an amazing accomplishment when you stop and think about that it was all privately planned, privately done, and privately financed.
At a time that was financially an interesting time in the country. I mean, this is occurring just right around Depression, right, as this is coming together?
Yeah, that was the underlying weak point, I think, in the demise of the original financing scheme, at least financially. The planning for this bridge probably, I mean, the detailed final planning probably started in the mid-20s, the roaring 20s, when there was a lot of promise about a lot of things, including how to make money. And by the time they got around to starting to build the bridge in 1929, well, guess what? That was the year of the stock market crash. And a lot of people probably thought, well, these things happen, we'll just kind of hold our breath. But they already had enough financing in place, I guess, to actually let a contract and start to build the bridge. And it opened in 1931, and the Great Depression was already pretty much in full swing then. And lo and behold, it went into receivership within a year. And some of that receivership, basically, I guess, bankruptcy, related to illegal financing arrangements and corruption and actual theft by the major promoters of this bridge, none of whom were from Lansing.
That's such a sad story to me in some ways, and I was reading about that a little bit myself the other day, and I just find it fascinating that this, essentially a group of local men decided, you know, hey, we want to do something to get our town on the map and to make it, you know, to support its growth and get things going, and so they have this beautiful idea, and personally, I think that's remarkable in its own right, that this group of men, you know, take on this project that they may not, and they ended up not seeing the results of. But it brings it back down to grassroots efforts, as far as I understand it, but then to see it kind of waylaid by corruption and greed.
Well, it is kind of an amazing story when you consider that it was largely not a local project. The financing for it was a Class A and Class B stock, and I've got a list of the final stockholders that were paid by the Iowa and Wisconsin Department of Transportation in the 1950s. These were the names that, they were the owners of the whole bridge and the highway right away to it and so forth. So that list gives a lot of insight as to who were the operatives behind this bridge. Very few of them are from Lansing. Hmm. And there's a lot of them from outside the state, a lot of them from other counties, Linn County, Blackhawk County, so on and so forth. But a lot of the local stockholders would have maybe anywhere from 2 to 10 shares at $100 per Class A share of stock. So a person that had maybe five or 10 shares, okay, that might have been kind of big money back then, but it's not like it's going to, you know, destroy a family or a farm or a business that had that kind of investment. So there's some mystery as to how all of this came about in the shadows of the city of Lansing that had not that much to do with the financing or building of the bridge. And when I was growing up, there was never any mention or even a whisper of any of this illicit background and why the bridge failed and a lot of the money had disappeared. And in my research, I got a copy of much of the original documentation of this bridge from one of the older gentlemen in town that was involved with it at the time, long since deceased now. But that was an eye-opener in that there were two boards of directors at one time for this bridge. And early on in the bridge history, in the early 30s, the one board of directors decided that there was a graft and corruption going on. So some of these people formed their own separate board of directors, which is really kind of incredible. Nobody, at least when I was growing up, nobody seemed to care about that. And maybe it's because a lot of locals just plain did not know this until these sources of documentation were revealed only in the last couple of years.
That's fascinating, really. And I want to give a shout out to a couple of Lansing pioneers that they are referred to as the fathers of the Lansing, of the Black Hawk Bridge. And that would be Tom Bakewell and J.P. Conway. And I found a conversation between the two of them that I thought was just really fun, because one day, apparently, they're sitting around having a conversation, and Jim said to Tom, "What else can we do for Lansing?" And we brought up the idea, "I want to see a bridge across the Mississippi River here." And the response was that it's too big to think about. And yet somehow they prevailed, even though it was such a big project. And the other guy's response was, "Well, why not? Let's try it. Nothing is too big to go for." And so their work, despite all of these other outside influences and despite all that went on behind the scenes and under the covers, as we say, eventually their dream did come into fruition.
Yeah, and an interesting angle there. There was a man by the name of L.J. Marquardt who worked for the Wisconsin Forestry Department in Madison. He was from Lansing, and he put together in 1916 a set of drawings, five different plates of drawings for a complete crossing of the Blackhawk of the Mississippi River, and his drawings showed several spans across the river, leading basically closer to DeSoto than the present bridge is. And that, it's interesting that on the Lansing side of his drawings, there was no connection with Highway 26, which is North 2nd Street in Lansing. His drawing showed the approach to the bridge going right through what we know as Little Hill today, cutting right through that that hill, and then landing, cars would land over north of Main Street. I mean, he hadn't thought that out too well. But this guy had the ability to put down on paper the same concept that Bakewell and Conway had. So it's that's a kind of a sidelight. But the important issue that I've thought about here is that this planning for this bridge and its start of construction in 29 was only about just a few years, up to maybe 5 or 6 years after the Congress created the Upper Mississippi River Fish and Wildlife Refuge. So you don't build bridges through the Fish and Wildlife Refuge anymore. But the reason that that was not a hurdle then is that even though Congress declared all of the Mississippi River, about most of the bottomlands between Red Wing and or between Hastings, Minnesota, and Rock Island, Illinois, is that they still didn't own any land. The federal government had to go out and buy the land that became the refuge. And then later in the 30s, of course, the predecessor to the Fish and Wildlife Service, or I should say the Corps of Engineers, had to buy even more land for the navigation system, the locks and dams. So if this all were to be someone's idea today, it really wouldn't go anywhere, because the Fish and Wildlife Refuge has precedent over almost any other civic project, and this, the final location of the new bridge that we're building now, was determined in a great measure by the minimizing the impact on the lands of the Fish and Wildlife Refuge. So that interesting timing there, it could have been much worse. But as it was, they got the bridge idea in while they could still buy private land in the river bottom, because all of that land was privately owned at the time that they conjured up this idea for the bridge. So there's just an interesting contrast there. And if it had been, say, 10 years later, I'm sure that bridge probably would not have been built.
Well, that's very interesting. And can you speak then to what is the impact in the area of having this bridge? I mean, how important is it to our communities?
Well, the greatest importance, obviously, is economic for the region and the community. And it's a heck of a way to test that, but I suppose theoretically the best way to test it is what actually happened. You just close off the bridge for a month or so and see what happens. Well, we found out that a lot of businesses in Lansing were severely impacted economically by that. We found out that folks, residents and businesses across the river and in the DeSoto and Ferryville area were severely impacted by not being able to get to Lansing for basic services, even groceries and so forth. So that by far is the most important impact. And then there's the less tangible impact of just the social connections between the Wisconsin side of the river and Lansing and much of Alamakee County, in fact. We have a state highway that takes off from the bridge, goes through Lansing, and goes all the way across to Iowa into South Dakota. And where we live, that highway is goes past our property. And we can tell probably as good as, or maybe better than most people in town, the great mix of commercial vehicles that are going by our house every day. And if that bridge wasn't there, the great majority of that mercantile transportation would not exist. So it is part of an interstate highway system, although not the typical interstate that we're used to. But Highway 9 is a cross-state highway, at least in Iowa.
Well, and I'm a big supporter of regional activities, and it just also seems like not having that bridge really does totally cut off the Iowa and Wisconsin sides of the river, which, again, when you look at there's small communities in that area with DeSoto and Ferryville, people there that go across to work in Lansing, you know, I know teachers, different people at nursing home or different stores, and just there's not only that, but just the interchange of relationship in that area is hugely important.
Well, as an example, the postmaster for the Lansing Post Office lives in Wisconsin across the river.
yeah. Makes it a little hard to get to work when that bridge isn't there. It's a long way around.
Although we did have a very excellent mitigation to that with the water ferry and the buses and so forth that picked up people and took them to where they wanted to go on both sides of the river. That the Iowa Department of Transportation put that together, and that was a fantastic job.
Yeah, we can talk about that, too, because it was a pretty fun ride. Actually, I tried that one day. So let's take a minute, though, and just remind ourselves that we are listening here to the program Conversations. And my guest today, I am Kayleen Welsh, and my guest today is Bill Burke, a local historian, and we're really glad to have Bill here to fill us in on some history and what's going on with the Black Hawk Bridge in Lansing. So, Bill, let's go back to the history just a little bit. So the bridge itself, after these guys got this project together and got things going, took a number of years to start seeing some things actually happening. But they started building in the late 20s, and for the first bridge, this first piece, came together in 1931 is when it was opened.
Yes.
And it was opened at that time as a toll bridge?
Yes, because it was a private bridge, and the way to make money for the stockholders was to collect tolls.
Okay. And, again, just doing a little bit of my own research, I saw that the original tolls were like 10 cents for a car and, or 25, wait, let me get this straight. It was 50 cents for a car, but it was 10 cents if you had an additional passenger. The horse and carriage and driver got across for 50 cents. One of the categories that struck me interesting was livestock on hoof were 10 cents to get across. I don't know if any livestock really went across there, but that was an interesting piece to think about.
I do remember going across the bridge in our family car with paying the tolls and seeing the toll signs on the side of the bridge. And also remember paying the tolls on the Prairie du Chien Marquette Bridge, which was also private at the time. So I have a somewhat of a vague memory, though, of going across that bridge and paying tolls. One of my uncles used to be a toll taker on that bridge years ago. And one of the stories here, and I don't think it's myth, but a lot of booze from Chicago was trucked westward from Chicago into Iowa and elsewhere across that bridge. And the thing is, the Prohibition years ended in 1933, a couple of years after the bridge opened. So the toll takers remember seeing these gangster-looking guys coming across the bridge there, and they suspected that they were just trucking booze, during the Prohibition era. And that came to a close in 2 years. But that one of the stories that I've heard from one of my uncles.
Interesting. And so can you speak at all to the name? How did we end up with the name Black Hawk Bridge?
You know, that there's an area of maybe some interesting research. I haven't come across anything that, that precisely answers the question as to who came up with the name, how was it decided. Certainly it was named after what they call him, Chief Blackhawk. He wasn't a legitimate tribal chief, but when his clan was defeated just a couple miles upriver from this bridge in the Black Hawk War, or Battle of Bad Axe in 1832, I would imagine that that stood out in people's minds as significant enough to name the bridge after Black Hawk. But another interesting anecdote here is, and you can read about this in the document called the Book of the Black Hawk Bridge, which was printed at the time. There's a story in there about the plan to put a metal plaque on the bridge describing Chief Black Hawk and some other historical tidbits. And of course, the question then is, well, where's the plaque? And there's no evidence that there was ever any plaque attached to some obvious metal girders on the shore part of the bridge. I believe that no plaque was ever manufactured. And that's because the plaque would have gone on the bridge at the end of the construction. And the bridge was already in foreclosure a couple of years after it was opened, and there was this corruption, including loss of funds and so on and so forth. And my hunch is that there was no money to turn around and build this plaque at the end of the process. So unless someone does some research to the contrary, I don't believe the plaque was ever built.
Well, that's very interesting, because I was reading in that book that you mentioned about the plaque and what it was supposed to say. And it sounds like there was a plan for this inscription that said, Black Hawk Bridge, to the memory of Black Hawk, Chief of the Sacs and Foxes, for his courage, loyalty, and devotion for his people, this tablet is inscribed.
Yes,
but no tablet ever came about.
Yes, that is the wording that was planned. And I don't believe any plaque was ever produced, because they certainly wouldn't have had money for that. They had a hard time just maintaining the bridge the way it was.
Well, and the bridge itself sounds like a bit of an engineering feat. When you look at some of the pictures, it's fascinating to me how it was like built from the outsides in, and then they dropped this last section into place.
Yeah, it's a cantilever type design, and I think that's a fairly common way of building a lot of bridges, because the two supporting members from the east and the west have to be built strong enough to hold the center unit that you talked about being dropped in place. And so if it can hold that very heavy center unit, certainly it can hold the weight of a crane that's out on the end helping to construct that center unit. But the center unit is held up by 8 metal straps, 2 on each corner. And if you're mindful enough to look at that as you're driving across, it's easy to imagine that if something happened with one or at least 2 or more of those metal straps, that would endanger that middle span to either drop away or be significantly disfigured so as not to be able to drive on it. And I think that's one of the reasons why a lot of older bridges are called fracture critical structures, is that there's no duplication of or redundancy in how the bridge is held together in case one key member fails. And so that's another practical reason why the state authorities would probably like to replace the present bridge.
And it sounds like when the, you know, so the bridge was opened in 1931 and quite the fanfare. You know, you can find a lot of information about the celebrations and the activities that happened there. And one of the things that I thought was fun was there was a parade. Apparently there was a route that started from DeSoto and went down to Ferryville and then met some more people, and then they came back up and went across the bridge, and so a big celebration in Lansing.
Yes, that is pretty well documented, and this was a regional accomplishment. And a lot of the stock was sold to people that we, you know, within the region. And there were parades. There was, you know, bands that came from La Crosse down here. The surrounding communities really got into the ethic of appreciating other communities' progress. And I think that's more so than you'd see today. But the description of the regional outpouring is really very gratifying.
It would be nice if we could get back to a little bit more of that today. I kind of like that idea.
Well, one of the things that kind of comes to mind, and you mentioned the celebration at maybe let's call it ribbon cutting, when the bridge was reopened in May of 57, I was in high school, and I had my Brownie Hawkeye camera that I was taking a lot of pictures of the community. And I decided I was going to sneak up on the bridge where all the authorities were from state government in Wisconsin and Iowa and everybody else. And I was going to take a picture of the ribbon cutting for the reopening of the bridge. And I did so. And I didn't have any problem getting right up next to the people that were shaking hands or cutting a ribbon or whatever. So I have a pretty authentic photo of that historic event, which I always thought was kind of special.
Nice to have. And kind of nice to know that you were there for this whole experience.
Yes.
Well, and so the bridge then, you know, opened in 31, carried traffic across for a period of time, but then ended up both with these financial difficulties and then kind of really got shut down as I understand a boat hit one of the slough bridges, or there was damage on the slough.
Well, there's a certain amount of myth about that, and I think there's room for some more documentary and investigation there. When the ice flows happened in March of 45, nothing happened to the Black Hawk Bridge. There were four sloughs. Actually, at that time, there were five slough bridges connecting the Black Hawk Bridge with the Wisconsin side. And two of those, the bridges and two of those sloughs were taken out by ice flows. And those bridges were built solely on wooden piling. There was no stone or cement used in the piers, you know, like with the main bridge. So there's been kind of conflicting information about, well, how come that we had ice flowing down the river in that kind of a situation? A couple things here. There was high water in March of 1945. It was more or less in flooding condition. And the Coast Guard cutter called the Fern was ordered up the channel to clear a passageway through the ice up either through a Lake Pepin or up to St. Paul, whatever. And normally, I mean, I always wondered why they did that, because normally the ice naturally breaks up and flows down the channel in March. And we used to live on the riverfront there for a while, and we observed that ourselves for many years. But the other part of the myth, and as far as I'm concerned, is not a myth, is that the federal government opened up a channel in the ice so that a military equipment or devices, whatever, could be floated down the river, because the World War II was still underway at that time, although the victory in Europe was only a couple months away. But the government itself, of course, did not know exactly when anything was going to end. So I have a hard time trying to figure out why the military would be building things in Minneapolis when they don't have any port up there, ocean-going port or anything. But if it was something even quite big, why couldn't they have gotten it out of Minneapolis by air? Why rely on a river that's totally iced up? There's just something there that deserves some further research. Now, my research on that goes back to the Murphy Library at UW-La Crosse. They have a secure library there of historic information, and that is clearly printed in the Minneapolis newspaper up there that it was a military components that the icebreaker was trying to get out of Minneapolis. Well, what the components, whatever they were obviously classified at that time. It was wartime. But I'd still like to see somebody delve into that and see if that was actually true. Why else would the Coast Guarder be slogging its way through the ice when probably in a week or two it would naturally remove itself anyway? Just something about that deserves a lot more research.
Well, and that was a decision that they made, or action that they took, that really made a major impact again then on the bridge, because it ended up being closed after that period of time.
Yeah, it's in fact, I think I came across one comment, one place where I don't know if it was the board of directors of the bridge or what, was considering suing the federal government because it was their decision and their watercraft that created the large chunks of ice that in high water is actually what took the two slough bridges out. So, of course, you're not going to get anywhere during wartime suing the federal government for hardly anything in that nature. So it's not clear yet in the historical records why those two slough bridges were taken out, except that it was taken out by ice. But why? I don't know.
Well, and what an interesting time, as you mentioned earlier, to be in Lansing, where you've got this huge, beautiful bridge, or this, again, whether it was seen as beautiful at that time, but this big piece of steel that really goes nowhere.
Well, yeah, we'd go up on top of Mount Hosmer, of course, frequently in Lansing, and we'd look out across the river, and 3 miles away, here's this beautiful set of hills, and we could see part of the city of DeSoto. Oh, I wonder what that's like over there.
Well, and that had to be just really weird for people, the people that had dreamt this or looked for this vision of this bridge, and now to see that it's actually been created, or but now it is really at this point useless.
We just, of course, as kids, you don't know squat about any of this kind of thing. We just assumed, well, okay, that bridge was there when I was born and hasn't been used, for most of kids' life up till that time. Oh, it's just always going to be that way. A bridge is just always going to be there. But we didn't know that the two state highway commissions were meeting somewhat regularly with representatives of the owners of the bridge, the board of directors, to buy it. And it's a good thing they decided to buy out this private bridge. Otherwise, I think there was an ad, actually, that went out into some outlet somewhere advertising the bridge for sale for scrap metal. So it came pretty close to not happening.
Well, I'm glad that Wisconsin and Iowa got their stuff together and kind of figured out what we needed to do to keep this bridge going. So
yes, they're to be complimented for that. I think each state put up $100,000 to buy out the stockholders and took it over a state highway. But back in the days of say the 20s and the 30s, a lot of this public infrastructure that's public now was built privately. The original water systems in many communities were private water systems. They were money making ventures by business people. They knew that there was a need, so they drilled their own wells, put in their own water pipes, and they made private money off these water systems, because it wasn't viewed that this was a proper role for government to be involved with these things. Well, as time went on and cities grew, then of course these did become public ventures, and this also goes to the distribution of electricity and even bus systems. Years ago, there weren't any public bus systems, hardly at all. They were private money-making ventures, and a lot of them went bust. And then they have had a hard time coming back. But they all got started privately.
All right, well, let's take a break a second. And again, I'm grateful for all the listeners tuning in today. My name is Kayleen Welsh, and this is an episode of Conversations on WDRT Radio. I'm very pleased to be here today speaking with Bill Burke, a local historian that's talking about the history of our communities and the Black Hawk Bridge and its influence on the area. And I guess let's get back to talking about a little bit more of the current situation. I mean, we got the bridge then reopened. In what year was that after it was closed down for this period of time, it reopened in the 50s?
Was opened in, it actually was drivable in late 1956, but they had the celebration and the ribbon cutting in May of 1957.
Well, and I was in error when I mentioned the parade earlier, because that was the festivity where everyone came from DeSoto and Ferryville, and they had this huge parade. That's what I understood anyway. Okay. It wasn't earlier. It was for this 50s reopening.
Well, but they had all of that in 1931 also.
Did they? Okay.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
They had a big regional to do in 1931.
Awesome. Well, and so the bridge then has been standing and in operation most of the time. There's been a couple of little hiccups here and there where it's been closed down overall, it sounds like. But this bridge has stood for a long time. And people from the area, I think, have become familiar with it. It's one of those bridges that we cross that we either like love to go across and love the view, or it's kind of terrifying. The bumps in the steel grade.
Well, you're right. And I've talked with several people through the years that don't like driving over that bridge. It's too noisy. It's too narrow. It's too steep. There are people I know that just are frightened of driving on that bridge.
Well, and it is an interesting bridge as far as the sound that it makes when you do go across. And it's here, to hear it referred to as noise. It's also referred to as the singing bridge.
The singing bridge, yes.
Different vehicles make a different sound as they go across, and so we hear this sound.
Yeah, I don't know of any other metal-graded bridge in the area. They added a metal grate to the, I think it was the Cass Street Bridge in La Crosse, and then they built a motel somewhat under it. And my understanding, I may be wrong about this, but my understanding that metal grate was then pretty soon replaced with concrete again, because just hearing the noise from the Lansing Bridge, and one can imagine that wouldn't be very compatible with a motel.
Either appreciated or completely unappreciated.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Well, and the bridge itself, has there been some stories, some fun things about the bridge? I mean, I know it was featured in one movie.
The movie was the Straight Story. But the movie was supposed to be this person driving his lawnmower across much of Iowa to Wisconsin, and the trip was over the Prairie du Chien Bridge.
Oh.
But they came to Lansing and photographed the Black Hawk Bridge because it was more distinctive, more picturesque, shall we say.
Okay. Well, and again, just kind of an interesting idea of how, as we present history, it's not always 100% accurate.
Well, that's right. Because the bridge is such a pleasing design to look at and everything, it is one of the most photographed attractions, I would say, in the Midwest. You just see pictures of that bridge all over, and rightly so. Of course, in a couple of years, it'll be gone. It'll be scrapped.
Well, that's a sad thing to think about in a way. So, but I'm glad to hear that the bridge that is being planned, the design of that, is similar in appearance?
Yes. It's. I don't know if it's a true cantilever, but it's going to have the same two towers on each side, and then with the middle tower, not tower, but the middle span, somewhat like the present one. It won't have the eight metal straps holding it up, like the present bridge, but it'll be very, very similar to the what will become the old Black Hawk Bridge. Yeah.
And I would assume that the name will stay the same. Have you heard any conversation about that?
Well, that's another interesting thing. I don't know if the states normally like to name their bridges. I know that the main bridge in between Rock Island and Davenport is called the Centennial Bridge. That has a name to it. Julian Dubuque Bridge in Dubuque and so forth. I don't know if the bridge in between Prairie du Chien and Marquette has a name. But I don't know if the state would have control over that or if the locality would be able to. Who's going to stop someone from referring to the bridge by a name? I don't think you could stop a community from doing that.
No, that's probably true. And actually, I heard that at one point it was a trivia question on Jeopardy, something about the name of the Black Hawk Bridge. I think
really?
It was in 2023, I heard something about that.
I wonder about that.
So not only regionally aware, but it's, you know, had gotten a little bit more exposure even than that.
Yes.
All right. Well, so let's talk a little bit more about, this recent closure has been difficult, but the bridge is open now. It's ready to go. People are driving across it, and it's kind of an interesting place to drive over there and just see all the construction. The piers are coming up. The cranes are, these huge cranes are in place.
Yes, it's kind of an education in itself just to observe what's going on there to build a bridge. Normally, the motoring public wouldn't get anywhere close to the site of a new construction project of that magnitude. But right now, you're driving within 40 to 50 feet of a lot of things going on, and they've got seven cranes over there now, and they've got one crane working on the Iowa shore for the Iowa pier, the main pier there. So it's an education in itself just to see how these things are done.
I think it's interesting to think about all the pieces that have to be even looked at and dealt with as you go into a project like this. But even environmentally, I understood that even as they were preparing for putting in the bridge, or there was mussels that needed, they moved, relocated some mussels from the river.
Yeah, the mussels, or as we call them, clams. This is because of the endangered species classification of a lot of these mussels. So they spent a good part of last year scooping these things up and relocating them somewhere in the river channel, up or downstream. I don't know where. But that was required as a part of the environmental impact statement.
Well, and that would that be the case really much anywhere, or is that because this bridge in this area is part of the Upper Mississippi Wildlife Refuge?
No, it'd be anywhere if if an organism is entered on the endangered species list, that's nationwide. Now, whether or not it would apply to a really small stream as opposed to a large stream, I'm not real sure on that, but a small stream probably wouldn't have this kind of wildlife on the river bottoms. But that was another requirement here, and that relocation project, it took, I'm sure that cost quite a bit of money because of the length of time it took.
Well, it'll be nice to watch the development over the next couple of years as this bridge comes into place. And I think it is fascinating to have the opportunity to watch this construction and process.
Yes, and the thing about watching it is that Mount Hosmer itself is an excellent place to observe what's going on, particularly with binoculars, because you're looking pretty much right down on the construction site. So it's a good reason to go up to Mount Hosmer and take a look at what's going on there.
Well, and I hope that after the closing again recently, that people from the area have a new appreciation of access across the river that way. Because it goes both ways. There's wonderful things in Lansing to visit, and, you know, businesses and things to do and jobs there, and vice versa. You know, I'm really grateful to have relationships with people from that side of the river that come over to this side of the river. And, you know, it does create, we have very similar interests in supporting each other's communities. And so I think that's just a really important piece.
Yeah. That's a very progressive way to be thinking about it, and because we were restricted from that type of interaction for over a month, now we appreciate it more.
Well, and I will know myself, I grew up in Lansing, or I grew up in the country outside of Lansing, and at the time, even going to school there, we had very little contact with the other side of the river. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's just as an adult, or because I've lived on the other side now, I have contacts mm-hmm. in both, but I appreciate so much that both has to offer. So I hope that other people get out there and explore both sides of these rivers.
I know back in before the bridge went out with the ice in 45, my dad was one of the school bus drivers that picked up Wisconsin students. I think there was something like 70 or 80 that came to Lansing for school. And then, of course, when the bridge went out, those students were then deprived of that education in Lansing, although they must have been reassigned to La Crosse or Pearl Deschene or some other place. But that was a connection that was severed back then. And, of course, when I was in high school, we had students from across the river in our classes, although that's not the case now, I don't think, with the school consolidations and so forth. But we had quite a few students from Genoa, Ferryville, DeSoto area.
Well, I think we have a whole lot more we could talk about, but I think we're kind of running low on time. So let's just share just a little bit about, do you have any idea what is the plan for the old bridge? Is there one?
Not that I'm aware of, except that everything else being equal, it will be removed and scrapped. And that will be fall into the jurisdiction, I believe, of the present contractor, unless they subcontract it out to maybe some demolition firm. Now, the environmental impact requirement always on something like this does require that it be put up for sale. This is just a bureaucratic requirement. And, of course, the Iowa DOT did that, and there was a couple of way-out kind of ideas on that, which are not coming true. But they had to go through that step just in case. So barring any other unforeseen development, that bridge will be taken down in some fashion and hauled away.
That'll be another interesting process to watch.
Oh, yes. We want to definitely photograph that.
Yes. And I even heard that maybe some of the construction of the new bridge will take place a little further downriver or something and float up. Is that true?
Well, yes. At one point, we heard that they were going to fabricate the new bridge at the now pretty much open Genoa power plant site. And so we've heard that that's no longer in the plans, but that they will fabricate it on barges on the shoreline right at Lansing. And I don't know if that's for sure either. But certainly it would be better to do that than have to fabricate it upstream several miles and then float it down on barges. Be cheaper just to do it right there in Lansing.
Well, it'll be an interesting process to watch as time goes on here, and we'll see what actually does come into place. And I think one of the biggest stories for me about this whole history of the Black Hawk Bridge is the importance of grassroots movements, the possibility, the power and potential that we can have as a group of citizens to create something important. And even if we don't get to see it come into fruition in our lifetime, you know, I appreciate the fact of these original, you know, developers or idea people that had this idea of the importance of this bridge, and not just thinking about their own current needs or how this would work, you know, currently, but really they were looking long term. They were looking to the future. And I think that's just such an important thing for us to think about now. So easy to get caught up in our own little worlds about what's important to us now, but how do we look at a bigger picture of the regional community, the regional needs, and what might be beneficial for people down the road?
Yeah, they were community minded. We certainly need a little bit more of that even now.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you taking the time to come over here today, Bill, to drive across that bridge in process. I know that after it was in state of repair and closed down, it's a little nerve-wracking even to drive over it the first time. It's like, okay, guys, do you have this stable now? But seems to be pretty stable.
I heard that there were some people that would not drive over it again.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they're going to wait a long time then, because 2026 is when we're going to see this new bridge, more than likely, hopefully, and we'll have a little time to watch all the process in the meantime.
Yes, a lot will be going on.
Yes. Well, thank you very much, Bill.
Thank you.